This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
And that last item provides a perfect segue.
Indeed it does.
Our guest on Journeys this morning, David Menadue, has been involved with HIV/AIDS activism since the late 1980s. Diagnosed HIV positive in 1984, his long association with the National Association of People Living with HIV/AIDS and his involvement with PLWHA Victoria and the Victorian AIDS Council have given him a high profile in the positive community and led to him being awarded the Order of Australia in 1995. David has also written his autobiography called Simply Positive. Today we are very privileged to have David as our guest on Saturday Magazine.
Welcome, David.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning.
And I would add to all of that, Nick, that really David, and you probably blush at this, but David's really an icon in our community, I think. You are. You've had such a public place in the gay community,
yes,
for so long. And
I was thrust into the limelight.
Well, you might have been thrust into it, but you're an activist in the true sense of the word, I think, not just kind of a rabble-rouser, but someone who is very active and has been, you know, incredibly active over quite a number of years.
Yes, thanks, Jeff. I mean, I guess even at university I like politics.
Mm.
I like the thrust of, you know, the way human beings sort of organise themselves. And when I sort of realised I was gay in the 80s, it was a matter of I had to be out. And to be out, and I was a country boy, and that was very difficult. So I wasn't out to my family and those living up in northern Victoria at all until, unfortunately, I, you know, became sick, which was far too long, and I really regret not being closer to my family, because I think if you're not out, you live a sort of separate life in the city, and you kind of, you know, there's a bit of stress in your relationship with your family. You avoid personal issues. So
do you think that creates an increasing sort of separation, or
it does
sort of distancing?
You know, I would rush home for, you know, school holidays, because I was a teacher at the time, and just spend a bit of time and then rush away and back to the bars, because, you know, that was where my family was at the time. That's the way I felt.
This was early 80s, was it?
Yeah, this was early 80s.
How old were you then?
Well, actually, late 70s, early 80s.
And you were just a young man then?
I was 30 in 82. Yeah. So, look, I think that 70s, 80s period was the golden time in my life. I suppose it is for anyone who's my age. Because, as you know, the 70s were liberation.
It was exciting, wasn't it?
It was exciting, and it was finally feeling we were coming into our own. You know, gay men were, you know, living in a much more unrestricted life, even though we didn't have law reform. Was it 81? Yes. We didn't get law reform in Victoria till 81.
I think that, it's early 80s anyway. I can't remember exactly when, but
my memory was it was impossible to be gay and not be political in that sense.
Yes.
That was almost inseparable.
Well, yeah, I think that's true to some degree. There were certainly people who you might say were only interested in the scene, but those of us that were interested in being activists, and that's sort of where my political drive came from. I mean, you know, we were involved. I used to sell this magazine called Gay Community News outside of Pokies. I'd stand there with this kind of futile exercise trying to sort of get the message about law reform or whatever the current thinking was across through this magazine, but half of the people, you know, weren't interested. They wanted the disco rags and
what do you think changed that for people? I mean, people have become more interested.
Yeah, certainly.
What happened, do you reckon? Was it just persistence of people like you standing out the front, handing out papers?
Oh, I think there'll always be a group of people that are just interested in, you know, having a good time, end of story.
Yeah.
But I think gay men have sort of come out as a community, and when you start meeting others like yourself, it's sort of like the more open, the more accepting society is, the more people will mature in themselves, you know, and not live double lives. And I think I was certainly fighting against that in the 70s, because I think even though we might say, you know, we had a few gay bars in Melbourne, like Pokies, for instance, or I think the Laird may have begun about 80.
Yeah, it must be knocking 30 years old.
But
now.
But there was a few bars before that. It's they were one night a week places.
Mm. Yeah.
So you, in a sense, you got this feeling of furtiveness.
Yeah.
Which they must have had in the 50s and 60s much more. You know, going to the Australia and watching as the cops would sort of waiting outside the door when you sort of came out.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been a horrible experience. Yeah.
Part of it's also, I think, to do with the expansion of the liquor licensing laws too. Because I remember going to the union or whatever it was, and you had to buy a bloody pie or something to get a drink after 10 o'clock. Mm. So I think there's been some changes there, but it kind of a growing up in some ways of our community overall. But I am intrigued. I mean, HIV/AIDS sort of hit the community with a wallop, and we'll go there. But in some ways, it was looking good, wasn't it, in the late 70s, early 80s? Ice. The world was our oyster. Mm. It was a great deal of fun in a way that I don't think is... as we've seen since.
Much more excitement. I used to love Pokies.
Oh, yes.
And there was an excitement and a buzz at Pokies that I don't find anywhere now.
Absolutely.
Well, we are all older, of course.
Well, that's
so
true.
You might need to ask somebody who's
well,
years younger
that's
about
true.
That.
But even Pokies then, you know, there was a wide age range of people used to go to Pokies. Absolutely. It wasn't just
that's
a single
true.
Age
yeah.
group,
yeah.
you know, and that doesn't happen so much now.
The market in the sense of the gay market is really divided up into different venues for different age groups and things, perhaps.
Well, now, in those days, I think... Because it was a smaller number, maybe we all went to all of them.
Yeah.
You know, I would go to Babes on a Monday night, and I would go to, you know, a certain place on Thursday, and Friday night it might be the Union Hotel. Mm. Do you remember the Union Hotel in Carlton? And then it would Saturday night would be, there must have been a club.
What was the place in Victoria Street, Richmond, used to have a drag show there a lot?
The Dukes.
Yeah,
I was
Dukes,
a regular
yes.
there.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was the...
We better stop this.
This sounding was like a few old codgers reminiscing, but it's...
No, I think what we're saying is that it was a period that everyone was coming out and enjoying themselves, but...
Yeah.
My first track, you know, I suppose this is predictable, but it's Donna Summer, I Feel Good, because I felt the 80s was about feeling good, and it was this whole... And I think, you know, you had women's liberation, you had the beginning of the pill, so there was sexual liberation, and then gay men, of course, were starting to feel that same thing. And I think with the music, gay men were the ones that responded to people like Donna Summer, the sort of upbeat stuff.
Well, why don't we listen to Donna Summer? You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy, and our guest in Journeys is David Menadue, and here's Donna Summer.
The fact that you became positive with HIV/AIDS changed things in ways you would never have expected
or
anticipate.
In dramatic ways.
And that was 1984. That was really... knowledge of HIV and AIDS then was very unknown, wasn't it?
And many people wouldn't get tested, Jeff, because they thought, why would I?
Yeah.
You know, there's no treatments. I'll possibly suffer discrimination, you know, from my friends or my workplace.
Which they did in many cases.
And they absolutely, that they did. I was fortunate not to. But I do think the stigma and fear was unprecedented in many respects.
Mm.
I mean, we haven't had a sexually transmitted kind of taboo-like disease like that for a long time.
Was when you were diagnosed, had they discovered the virus and the means of transmission at that stage? I can't remember the exact dates, because I know there was a big unknown period for a couple of years where nobody knew anything about what was going on.
Gay-related
immune. The gay cancer.
Gay-rid syndrome, and they called it HTLV when I was actually diagnosed. Mm. They hadn't actually called it immunodeficiency virus at that stage. So, look, yes. And I had picked it up without knowing it was in Melbourne.
Mm.
You know, I think I remember Adam Carr writing the first piece in a gay press article about this mysterious cancer that was appearing in gay men in New York, and they were kind of linking a Amyl nitrate.
Mm.
I said, well, thank God I don't use Amyl nitrate every night of the week, but I did occasionally. But I thought, as it all sort of turned out, of course... it was sexually spread, and it was circulating in Melbourne before we knew it, and that was a bit of a shock to a lot of us, because, you know, you think until you see evidence of it around you, you don't imagine that you know, any of us are at threat.
Mm. Mm.
So I had these swollen lymph glands for some 6 months or so, and the doctor said, oh, we'd better keep an eye on that, that's a bit unusual. And sure enough, when the test became available in 84, see, because I'd been open about my gay, my sexuality, at least with my friends and workmates and so forth down here, I had no patience for secrets.
Mm.
And I do understand why people, you know, my housemate, for instance, certainly didn't go and get tested for those reasons I said before. He didn't want to know in many respects. He just assumed he was, probably. He'd had the same sort of sexual practices as me, and, you know, nobody was using condoms because we didn't think we had to.
Mm.
So, and then he turned out to be negative and I turned out to be positive. I wasn't initially worried because Dr. David Bradford, who was my doctor at the time, said, well, we're beginning to think it's probably like the hepatitises. Only 1 in 10 people actually go on to develop full AIDS.
Mm.
And I thought, well, 90% odds, I can live with
that.
It's
pretty good,
that's,
yeah.
That's not bad odds. But, of course, as the 80s unfolded, we realised that, you know, it was more possibly going to be 100% of people who developed AIDS. And fortunately, that wasn't true either, but...
But it did look like it for quite some time.
For quite some time, it looked like no one was going to be able to.
What sort of impact did that have on you, personally, and in your activism as well?
Look, I know this is going to sound strange, but the very early days of my life, of being positive, I wasn't so worried about dying. I mean, it's hard to believe you're going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even when people have cancer, they think... Well, I feel okay, you know, and nothing's... And I was as robust as anyone in the early 80s when I, you know, I thought... What I was worried about was sex. You know, I was worried about people rejecting me because
right.
I had this horrible, you know, contagious disease. And I that I think, the thought that I was never going to have a life partner, possibly, or that maybe I might even not have sex again... Although that happened, but it took a while for me to build the confidence to actually have...
Yeah, well, I mean, there was that whole fear thing was very much very present, and that was, you know, a big part of the problem, wasn't it? That people were frightened, and some people became celibate because there were ads going around or things being said, you know, the only really safe sex is abstinence and stuff like that, so... It kind of like condemned people to these austere, horrible kind of lives.
And I think if you have one or two negative responses from someone when you're actually up front and tell them you're positive, like, you know, I had one guy tell me after, you know, we had our clothes off, you know, what? And I said, oh, I just suddenly had this desire. I had to tell him I was positive. You know, I thought, oh, you know, for goodness sake, I've been living with this secret. I want... someone that'd be totally accepting of it and no dramas. And he said, what? He said, why didn't you tell me after I bought you the first gin?
Oh.
I thought, well, you know, how creepy is that?
Yeah.
I mean, he's just one person, and I had lots of positive, you know, pleasant experiences where people didn't care one bit. And I thought, oh, we're using a condom. What's the big deal? So... Unfortunately, sometimes people tend to think those negative things are the things that are going to colour your judgment for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You've got to take good with the bad, as I realised.
Yeah.
But I think I can understand why some people, you know, find this whole disclosure issue still an issue, even
but
now.
But still now, you think?
Well, you know, we're jumping a whole period, but that whole horrible period of treatments and so forth, but finally when we've got onto it... And now it's not as obvious that you have HIV if you're taking your drugs and so forth. The real problem now is, to some degree, HIV's gone back into the closet.
Yeah.
You know,
so what do you think about that? What do you think about disclosure and whether people have an obligation to disclose or whether it's healthy to disclose? Or where do you stand on disclosure?
Well, I don't know how... I think people have to build the confidence.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, very difficult for a lot of people who are sort of learning sexual negotiation skills, or even for a lot of us, depending on where you meet someone, to actually say it, blurt it out in that environment. I mean, you want to get them home, have that sort of intimate arrangement where you can sort of make it easy.
Mm.
But, you know, the question is, once you've got them home, you think they're going to slip through your fingers if you say it. And that, I think there are some people who it's going to be difficult for them to do on their first occasion. They think, oh, this is probably a one-night stand. Why will I bother?
Yep.
Then, of course, they keep dating somebody, and then it becomes an issue. Mm. You have to tell them, and then you're thinking, well, they're going to think you betrayed them.
Yeah. But what about in the social and employment context? I'm wondering, a lot of people would see an HIV diagnosis as, or a HIV positive test, as an identity. Like, it's like it assumes such a strong place in the minds of some people that they see you as the HIV positive person, almost like it's an ethnic identity or
you
a gender
disease,
identity. Yeah. It's like you are the disease kind
of thing. They're trying to avoid that. Mm.
Do you think that's true? Do you think that's how people see it, or do you think that's...
They may see people like me like that because I've, you know, been very vocal about it, and I've been involved with people living with HIV/AIDS. I think your average person with HIV probably feels a little bit of that's little part of them that is dealing with, you know, well, I'm positive and that makes me different. But the rest of their lives and the way they're in the workplace and the way they deal with their friends and their family, I mean, it's really possibly, I hope, not a major issue.
Mm.
What concerns
I would hope that as
me
well.
Is I think some people carry it around without hardly telling a soul.
Yeah.
And it's like any secret that festers.
Yeah.
You know, you
can't... It chews away at you
so
in
you
some
need to
sense,
have a couple
it?
Of good mates. You need to be able to have a good relationship with your doctor where you can talk about anything.
Yeah.
And I think you need to realise that, you know, get rid of this stigma. Most people in Melbourne are used to HIV in terms of the gay scene. It's not a big issue.
And the whole thing of the psychological response to it also probably affects physical health in some ways as well, I think.
I think so.
I think. We're speaking with David Menadue and Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, a little less straight than other radio stations.
And yes, you are listening to Joy 94.9, Saturday Magazine with Jeff and Nick, and our guest this morning on Journeys is David Menadue. And you've got a bit of a song you'd like to run.
Oh, look, this song is not every gay man's, but a lot of gay men's anthem. And I just am, it's I Am What I Am by Gloria Gaynor.
And you are what you are.
You know, I can see it. There's a pattern developing here, a bit of a disco bunny. But look, I think this is important. It came at an important time in my life, coming out as a gay man, but also, as I said, the HIV positivity for me was like coming out all over again.
Mm.
And, you know, feeling good about yourself, and no matter what the rest of the world thinks, I am what I am. It's just a sentiment that a lot of us understand very, very much.
Well, it's a longie. Let's roll a little bit of it, shall we?
I am what I am. Well, I think it means being out about your status to a large degree, and also, lobbying government and lobbying... But giving HIV a profile, I think that was the real problem in the 80s, that people with HIV didn't have a voice.
Mm.
And I was thrust into the role almost, not really thinking about the consequences. I hadn't told my family, and here I was fighting for the opening of our centre, the community centre for people living with HIV. We'd been trying for 3 or 4 years to get one, and all the... In Caulfield, for instance, the residents objected to us trying to get our own place, and so they had this huge fight with council over it. And
like
the media,
the plague into
Well, they thought we'd be wild party animals that would throw needles over the fence.
Were the AIDS councils established at that stage?
Yes, yes. The people living with HIV/AIDS, though, were just getting off the ground.
Right.
I helped. I was one of the founding people for people living with HIV/AIDS, and I'm not sure what we thought we would be able to do with small numbers, but as it became quite important to actually hear from positive people, because people out there in the community wanted to get actually... This sort of was a mysterious, you know, you had your Grim Reaper image. It was really important to have a real human face actually delivering the message and say, look, I'm normal like anybody else. So here was I standing in front of the, you know, all the major media, the television channels and so forth, and we were, you know, splashed across the pages. And that was one of the first times we'd actually done media in Victoria with actual people with HIV. And so the actual fact that I was willing to be open about it, and, you know, a lot of people thought they were going to have rocks through their windows or, you know, that people would recognise them in the street and say, oh, you know, there's the AIDS victim or something. And none of that happened to me. And, you know, I think the truth is that the world's a big enough place that you can, you know, unless you're a major celebrity, you know, pop celebrity or something, you're not, you know, those things don't happen. And I found a little bit of strength in being able to actually communicate a message and hopefully try and build down the isolation. Because I really agree with what you said before, Jeff, that the mental aspect of HIV really led to so many people's health deteriorating, not quite as much as the physical, because some very strong people, very strong-willed people still... you know, eventually succumb to HIV. It's not about, you know, positive thoughts will overcome it.
No.
But there were some people who, you know, I saw it in friends of my own, I just hated the thought of living with this.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, I just prefer to die. And I know that sounds dramatic. And so I think you have to change the perceptions of the way people with HIV felt about themselves. And the only part of the way you have to do that is to change the way society thinks about them. So getting messages out there, having a public profile, and, you know, occasionally writing pieces and eventually writing my book.
What's been some of the significant aspects of your journey in terms of moving from what was seen as a death sentence to... being HIV positive for now, what, 24 years?
Yes.
What's that journey been? What have been the high points of that journey for you in terms of that changing perception or the changing medical possibilities with all of that?
The high point was 96. There's no doubt that's when the treatment started working.
Right.
You know, I still was going to, you know, several funerals a month in 95.
Yeah.
96 was when it started.
And the papers were full of obituaries. And,
it was a truly horrible time. And for those of us that had a lot of positive friends and supported people, you know, I lost three housemates. You know, it was all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
so close,
it was horrible.
So close to you. It was really like being part of a war.
Yeah, it was.
And, you know, all of us here, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're positive or negative, you went through it to some degree. You know, it was hugely... and the gay community, honestly, the way the gay community rose to that is really brought out our heroes. You know, some of the people in this community and what they did to help people, both...
Yeah.
You know.
And the symbolic importance of the quilt project, I think, was really important as well.
No, it was very important for people to be able to let that grief out, you know. But yes.
So with World AIDS Day coming up and your book coming, what do you think's the story? What's the action you would like to see people engaging in now?
It's becoming harder to keep people involved because a lot of the younger people with HIV who've lived in an era where they know they can treat or, you know, if they monitor their virus and they know when they need to treat, they realise that the average lifespan they have may well be a normal one. You know, they may live the average lifespan at the moment something in the order of 37, 40 years or something. But it'll get better as the treatments improve.
Yes.
So for them, they don't feel any great feeling as if they need to sort of...
No sense of urgency or anything.
Not particularly, but I think there is a... Sorry, I'm sort of lost there.
No, it's about younger people who have...
Oh, yes, it's going... Sorry, I was...
In an age of treatment, yeah.
I forgot about what the question was. No, it's just trying to get people at PLC involved in the whole grief process. A lot of them are finding that hard to do because it's not part of their reality now. And they don't particularly want to go and see people talking and lighting candles and, you know, and some of them are confronted by it. It's hard. And yet there are people with, you know, family and mothers and fathers who want to come and remember their child because they live with them forever. So, and it's the same for me. I want to do it. I want to actually go and remember my friends at these ceremonies.
It's very important. I think it's very important that young people, it's a little bit like the whole Anzac Day thing. Like, let's remember that, you know, war's pretty horrible and not glorify it, but say, well, let's not let this happen again. And I think it's the same with younger people. It's important to remember that part of our history.
That's right.
Because that's contributed a lot to the kind of lives that young gay and lesbian people live these days, I think. Been a significant... Now, your book, Positive, tell us about the book. What have you covered in the book?
Well, I used to... Well, I still do write for Positive Living magazine that appears in MCV. And I'd had a whole series of articles I'd written over 15 years, and I just put it to a publisher and said, would you be interested in publishing these? It's sort of a chronicle of 20 years of AIDS. Oh, no, he said, that's not mainstream enough. I want you to write something about your whole life. And I said, but, you know, my story as a child and growing up and stuff, it's nothing. It's just an ordinary story. Nothing out of the ordinary. He said, oh, no, look, there aren't a lot of gay men's biographies written in Australia. And
when you looked at it, how ordinary was it really when you've actually got around to doing it? Did it feel that ordinary?
I think the last 20 years have had some pretty amazing ups and downs, but before that, I led a fairly typical, what I call gay boys' life. I was, you know, I was bullied and all that stuff at school. I'm not saying all gay boys are, but, you know, I was living in a country school where to be a pufter in a, you know, a sheep and wheat area was a pretty rough
and a brave thing to be if you were that out.
The same story, the story for people growing up in rural areas, of which I'm one, is it's a very similar story. It's the whole rural thing makes it very difficult. Time for us to wind up. It's gone very quickly, David, and we could talk to you for another hour. It's kind of fascinating because you've been so much a part of the history of HIV and AIDS in Australia from the very beginning, and you've kind of got some very great perspectives on that, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Okay.
So thank you very much for joining us on Saturday Magazine and for telling us your story. And David's book is called Positive. It's published by whom?
Alan and Unwin. Unfortunately, Jeff, it's probably out of print. You can get it off Amazon.com if anyone's interested. They now download books, you know, not so much for publishing. It's all...
I know, and there's these new instant print things that are coming into bookshops these days that, you know...
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.